Comrades and friends, hello. We're here with superstar stand-up comedian, state rep, and historian and historical narrative teller, Medina Wilson Anton. What's it?
What's up? Yeah, you can call me Ken Burns.
Yeah, I mean, the first two episodes of Storm the Fort dropped to, yesterday, if you're when you're hearing this, but today as we're talking, and they're just incredibly good. So yeah, congrats on. On an incredible piece of work. I listened to the first one again. I've listened to the first one now, I think, a few times because I listened to it during the process. And yeah, just the conversational style too, like when you talk about like the Irish famine or like free labor of black slaves in the South, and you're just like, what? I mean,
Yeah.
just like because it just adds because you and Carl have a great rapport anyway because you've known each other for a long time, and so it just really comes off. And I'm so happy that I could be just a little tiny part of it. It's
Well,
great.
yeah, thanks for hosting the project, and like letting us use the studio when you were not even home, and like you have a major role in how this all came to be, and I just want to shout out Carl for the amazing research and dedication he put into the project. I just like showed up and performed. And like as the project went on, I started to kind of like pause and be like, okay, can we rework this sentence or like can we edit this? But in the earlier episodes, I'm kind of reacting in the moment, which is I wasn't sure if I was supposed to, and Carl was like, no, this is cool. Let's leave that in. That's fun. Let's leave it in. So
Yeah, I didn't know
I'm
how he was
glad
going to
you're
do it too.
enjoying
And when I first heard that back and forth, I'm like, oh, this is going to be so good. So yeah, I am really
it.
enjoying it. For people who haven't maybe gotten to the second episode yet, I make my debut as the man, the myth,
Ooh,
the legend,
yes.
Terrence Powderly. So I'm very
Oh
excited
man.
about that too.
I cannot wait to hear your role in there. There was like when we were recording, we would just say the quotes in case we didn't have anybody to come through and like, bring life to them. And there were some of them where I'm like, I really hope that you can get Rob to do this because I feel like he's going to do a really good job. So I'm excited to get to episode two. I'm like I said, I'm halfway through the first episode. And I will probably finish on the way back up from Dover today. I'm down in Legislative Hall. I'm currently sitting on a floor cushion on the floor in my office with the door closed in the dark because you got to do some things for yourself.
You need to take time for yourself, especially there, especially there. So,
Yeah.
before we get to our main show today, which is a discussion with two local environmental activists, Sarah Bucic and Amy Rowe, I wanted to talk to Medina quickly and give everybody information about some events that the Delaware Call is sponsoring coming up in May. There are tickets available. They all go to a good cause. Medina's involved in them. Number one is a film screening. The night of May 3rd at Bootless Theater in Wilmington, we'll be screening the documentary film from Al Jazeera English, the short documentary Stand Up for Medina, about your work to try to get the passage of a ceasefire resolution in Dover last year, at the same time where you were really starting to go out and do stand up on a regular basis. So it's a really interesting juxtaposition. I think people will really enjoy it. And also, after the screening, we're going to have a panel discussion with the director and the producer, Zineb Sultan, and Jess Corain and Medina. So it's going to be a really cool event. I think a lot of people are looking forward to it.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really excited. When the project came out, the genocide was still happening. We had kind of like a little tiny ceasefire after that, and then now the violence has continued. And so it's again a really relevant topic for us to be talking about. And Zainab is an amazing filmmaker, amazing person. So I'm excited for an audience here in Delaware to get to hear from her and learn more about what made her, do the project and where she sees things going.
Yeah, there'll be a link in the show notes to buy tickets. The proceeds will be split between the Delaware Call nonprofit independent newsroom and an aid organization called Heal Palestine, mostly for the medical and sort of the needs of the children that are being just massacred every day. I don't mean to bring anybody down. I haven't talked about this on the show, but I haven't been able to watch it. But another war crime was documented. The Zionist just summarily executed medics in the field, fired upon an ambulance convoy, murdered unarmed people. And then when people came to try to get them, murdered them as well, and then buried them all with a bulldozer to try to in a mass grave, a la, Nazi shit. And it got discovered. And so I can tell you that my patience to listen to any Israeli Zionist bullshit is negative. So if you see me, I would recommend not bringing it up because I'm not fucking having it. And I think that at least, the people who are at least keeping this atrocity, this apartheid, and this genocide at front of mind, even in this time where, we're not in a great position nationally in politics, it doesn't matter. We got to keep this front of mind every day when we're talking about foreign policy. Right out of Dover, we're shipping. I mean, that massacre of those medical professionals and folks was probably done with guns and bullets that we sent from Dover. Very good chance of it. I don't know that, but there's a excellent possibility. And so, yeah, everybody,
We're all culpable,
we're
regardless
complicit.
of how, close to home it is. It's our taxpayer dollars, and it's revolting and it's disgusting. And I mean, we haven't talked about this yet, but like this week, the US, I think it's like Immigration and Citizenship. I forget what the official title of that department or division is, but they put out guidance saying that they're going to be monitoring social media for, in quotes, anti-Semitism, when they are going through people's applications for immigration benefits. So if you're looking for a visa, you're looking to get a green card, and so I actually put out information on that to my constituents and followers, saying, watch what you post on social media. Maybe don't talk about Palestine and foreign affairs if you're applying for a visa or you're trying to reunite your family. And honestly, I struggled with that because I feel like I have a duty and a responsibility to inform people the best ways to keep themselves safe. At the same time, I think it's more important now than ever before for people that do have citizenship, who do have that privilege, to get even louder. Because the goal of all of these policies, these fascists, authoritarian style policies, is to scare people into silence. And I think the reason why is because they know that they are not going to win the narrative war. They're not going to win public opinion because they're try not to curse. They are despicable. I'm not even going to say human beings. They're despicable entities that are hurting, killing, maiming, massacring innocent people. And there's no way you can paint it to make it look like anything else. And so, what they want is for us to just stop talking about it. And that's how they win, is by silencing us out of fear. So, I've been carrying my passport on me, and I'm going to continue to say what I've been saying. I'm going to continue to be vocal, but I'm also encouraging folks that I know who are in precarious immigration statuses to be very careful. And it's really hard for me even to process that. Like, that's something that we have to say in these United States of America, but that's the reality that we're dealing with now.
Yeah, I feel the exact same way. I am a white guy. I'm a citizen, and I will redouble my efforts, and I will curse about it, and I'll tell anybody this is a fucking genocide. It's disgusting. If you think, if you're a Zionist to me, at this point, after everything we know and everything I've tried to teach you, you're a fucking scumbag. And so you can't come get me. You can't make me leave. I won't be leaving. And it's sad. I talked to somebody who married a woman in Colombia. She got her green card and came here just this week to activate that, and because she's going to be moving here to work. And I just said, make sure you don't tell them you know me, you know, take my number
It's
out of your phone,
really.
take my number out of your phone, whatever you got to do. And I hate to say that. I want people to have solidarity and be able to say what they want, but you got to keep people safe at this time. And we'll just keep people who can fight, we'll keep fighting, and we'll see where it goes. But we're not gonna let up one bit.
Yeah, 100%. So, I appreciate, Delaware Call's work in bringing light to important issues that are often overlooked in local media. And so this is, I think, another great example of a great program locally. You can support local media, support the arts, and support a good cause, with Heal Palestine and have some solidarity, right? In like times like this, it's important to be around people that don't make you question your sanity when you're like, I feel like genocide's bad. I feel like it's bad. And it's refreshing to be around people who are like, I think it is bad. I think war crimes are bad,
I think we're the bad guys here.
So, and then what's the other event we're
Well, the
doing?
good
Do you want to
news,
intro that?
yeah, that's what I was going to
Bring the
say. So
mood up
now
a little
we're gonna
bit.
we did this on purpose. Now we're gonna bring the mood up, you know, so because we always want balance. We want balance here. We have one on May 17th, Saturday. There's going to be a huge comedy show, same venue, Bootless Theater, headlined by Medina. And it's going to be shot as a special, big professional shoot. It's going to be great, and there are tickets available for that. For that event, there is a special VIP ticket available. There's not going to be many of them. I think maybe there's 10, potentially 15. But because we're having a professional crew come in, we need to have a rehearsal party. They need to block out their cameras. They need to check on the audio. They need to do all of that stuff. And so the performers will be there, and we're going to have a sort of a private VIP party on Friday night. That also gets you a ticket for Saturday night as well. They're $100, but we'll have food and drinks at the party. It'll be a nice time if you get in time. We haven't even really been promoting this, and I see we've sold two or four of these already. So everyone's going to be, if this is something that you're into, you really enjoy it.
Yeah,
And
it's gonna be fun.
maybe you can talk a little
We
bit more
won't
about the.
talk about genocide, maybe. I don't know, maybe. But yeah, it'll be a fun night. It's me and my comedy bestie, Belinda Clear, who's another local comic who's been in the comedy game for decades now. Started in the 90s, and she is absolutely hilarious. I hit open mics and shows with her all the time. I hear material all the time, and I still am moved to tears with just how hilarious she is. So, it's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be a great show. Liam Katz, is going to be hosting. He's a hilarious comedian as well. Really excited for our Bootless, our last show at Bootless, actually. So Bootless Stageworks, local nonprofit, that's been bringing theater, live theater to the Wilmington community for years now, is actually going to be moving from that location. And so this is going to be our last comedy show. We've been hosting a monthly show there for years. This will be our last show at Bootless Stageworks on Broome Street. So we've been saying we're going to blow the roof off. We're going to really knock down the doors on the way out, and it's going to be a great show. So make sure you get your tickets. Limited seating, because we got to make sure we have enough space for the crew to get around and get all those shots and stuff. And don't worry, we're not going to come for the audience. It's not going to be like a Matt Rife special where we just
No
glam
crowd
you
work.
up and
Making fun of my
yeah. I mean,
glasses. Look at this old guy with his
I
glasses. Get out, leave me
mean,
alone. Leave me alone.
I'm sure there will be some crowd work, but it'll be tasteful. It'll be funny. It's not going to be it's offensive and so sit in the front if you get there early. And yeah, I'm really excited. I'm looking forward to it. And it's another great benefit show benefiting the Delaware Call. Again, really important that we support local media. And I'm just appreciative that we get to do this for our last show.
Yeah, too crazy to quit. The link will be in the show notes. You're not going to want to miss it. And again, it's the sort of the last hurrah for this particular space. The group that the theater group that's managing that space will be finding another venue. So it's a really cool, intimate space at 13th and Broome in Wilmington in the St. Stephen's Lutheran Church. Is that what it's called?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's a really unique space. So get tickets now because I think the capacity is around 100. So it's not going to be huge. It's going to be very intimate, and you're going to want to see it because it's going to be a very special event.
Yes, and the space is wheelchair accessible. All are welcome. And yeah, I am so excited. It's going to be so much fun. And I can't wait to see how it turns out.
Medina, thank you so much for jumping on. We're going to start our regularly scheduled program in 1 minute. And as we always say, Philistine Hura, and left
Left
is
is
best.
best.
That's goddamn right it is. In the shadow of Rockford Tower, behind enemy lines, in the belly of the Delaware Way beast. I am Rob. This is the Highlands Bunker Podcast. Hello. As always, we are joined by Kay Foster Stomberg, super producer. By the time you hear this, the first episode of Storm the Fort, the chronicle of the Knights of Labor, is going to have dropped. Huge podcast. Medina and Carl really crushed it, and I'm very excited for this whole series to go out. I think it's incredibly important for more reasons than I can count. But obviously, we've talked about it quite a bit. You will enjoy it when you see it. So, getting into today's program, the last few weeks or months, I feel like have been a lot of sort of drama and funny business. And so I wanted to kind of get back to the bunker roots. And so today we have joining us two advocates, two environmental advocates from Delaware that I'm just interested in hearing their story and what they think about the environment that we're working in here in Delaware. So we have Amy Rowe. Amy, hello. Thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
And Sarah Bucic. Hello, Sarah.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having us tonight.
Thank you. Did I say your last name correctly?
Nailed it. It was perfect.
I got a little help because somebody gave me a little. I've followed many European footballers from that region. So when they told me that, I was like, I know exactly how to do it. So
that was perfect.
Thank you so much. The first question I always ask everybody, because I'm just very interested in, and either one of you can take it, I guess. I'm interested in both, but. How did you find your way to sort of public advocacy, like having an idea and being like, I'm going to go out in public and, persuade my neighbors and talk to the press and go to the legislature and talk about this issue? Like, how did you seem motivated to do that?
About lead?
About anything. I mean, it depends. Did you start with lead, or were you always sort of a person who was active in the community, working on issues, organizing your neighbors, or was it specifically the environment and lead?
Well, Sarah and I have been friends for a long time, and we met through advocacy. So we both have been doing this for a long time for a lot of reasons. And we worked together. Our first project was about the air monitoring at the Delaware City Refinery. And that was, oh gosh,
2011 and 2012.
2011 and 2012, yeah. And we didn't know about lead at the time, it wasn't on our radar at all. We had a kind of a rude introduction to the lead issue surrounding, and Sarah, maybe you want to talk about this, a sandblasting of a water tower next to Sarah's house.
Yeah, so as Amy said, we met I used to live in Delaware City, and I had founded the Delaware City Environmental Coalition, and we had done air monitoring in Delaware City, and that's how I met Amy. We got some results, and I needed somebody to help me put some of the stuff together. And so I became friends with Amy probably 15 years ago. And then I had moved actually up to Wilmington. I am now right off of Philadelphia Pike, and I live next to a water tower. And about 2 years into me living here, this person came over from the water utility and said, we're going to start sandblasting this next to your house. And I had remembered somebody told me there was lead paint in the water towers. My background's in nursing, so I was concerned about this. I had an eight-year-old at the time. So I just asked the guy from the water utility, I said, are you going to be removing lead? And he's like, oh, yeah, no one ever asks that. And I was like, so what are you going to be doing so it doesn't, like, get all over the place? And, you know, I might, it's, like, literally less than 80 feet from my house. So, you know, they put up these curtains and things like that. And the project really just got very involved. There was, like, like containers at the end of my driveway that, you know, was for hazardous waste that the EPA, you know, would like, they would transfer to, you know, a hazardous waste facility. And I started finding, you know, paint chips in my driveway. And so I was just testing them, you know, using those lead paint tests you get from Home Depot. And I just started, having been an advocate for many years, I was like, okay, I'm going to call Denrick. I'm going to call public health. And, like, we're going to get this all figured out. And they just kept pinging me back and forth. And it was just like, okay, so what now? You know? And so Amy and I talked about it and we were like, well, let's make it, you know, let's make this process have a rule so that when you do stuff like this, you can't just, like, blow, you know, lead paint chips into people's yards. So we started researching water towers throughout the state. We found some other projects that had happened where there was breaches of containment. So we made it, we made a permitting process. So when people, there's actually over, like, I don't remember how many water towers there were, Amy. We had a crowdsourced map. We had people, like, telling us where water towers were. It was, like, a lot. You'd think there was, like, 12 or something, but there's, like, tons of them everywhere. And some of them are right next, like, I live right behind high school, near an elementary school. So, you know, these are all throughout the state. And when we created the permitting process, we wanted there to be, like, an emergency plan. You know, we wanted people to be notified, you know, stuff that you think would be really normal and obvious. And one of the things, one of the reasons Amy and I were really upset, and we thought this had already happened, we thought that there was already a process in place for this kind of stuff, because if you're old enough, you remember the St. George's Bridge, which was a huge debacle. So back in the early 2000s, they redid the St. George's Bridge, and there was, like, huge chunks of lead paint, you know, going into the river, and they had to test all the kids in St. George's. So I remember that. I was in college at the time. It was all over the News Journal. And so I was like, I can't believe they still allow people to remove lead paint without telling them, you know, on, like, a public structure. So we made it so that you had to have a permit for it. And then we were like, so you're not going to put lead paint back on it. And they were like, well, we're not going to, but it's legal. So that's when we started working on the lead paint ban. And so we're still the only state that is illegal to apply lead paint outdoors. So that's kind of the beginning of our story.
Yeah, I wanted to get into a little more of, like, you guys seem like you have a cool origin story, sort of meeting and already being, like, involved in, or at least attuned to things that are going on in your community, the environment, the air, the water. But not everybody even thinks that way. So it's just, it's a neat sort of way that you guys got together. I know people from Delaware City. I lived in Wilmington and Newark my whole life, but obviously Delaware's a small place. And, you know, having those refineries down there, even when I didn't know a lot about it and I was younger, I thought, yeah, that can't be that healthy with everything that's going on down there, whether it's lead paint or emissions or anything else. So it's interesting that you sort of knew that intuitively, and were like, yeah, the environment's going to be an important thing, you know, for us. That's pretty cool. I guess my question then from that is, if we're the only state, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think I heard you right, we're the only state that allows the application of lead paint outdoors, the opposite. We're the only one that doesn't because of what you've done.
Well, yes.
That's right.
It's when people say lead paint was banned in 1978, what they mean is it was banned to use inside houses. So it was still used, you know, obviously it continued being used because it was, people had it in their shelves and everything, but it was used on things like playground equipment, fire hydrants, lines on the roads, those bright yellow lines, a lot of places that very high lead content. So a lot of bridges water towers. I mean, it's lead is very durable, so people used it on outdoors, so, you know, except when it gets to have to be removed, it's a huge mess. So
Yeah, Delaware is the only state that's banned that. And when we decided to ban it, we were just like, okay, we're going to ban it. And then we reached out to a fellow who wrote an article that we read. We're very much into the nerd aspect of advocacy. So we like to do our homework. And we read an article by this fellow for this international NGO called Occupational Knowledge. And they do a lot of lead paint work in Africa and other continents. Anyway, this article was about how we should ban lead paint on outdoor structures. And I said to Sarah, let's do it. Let's just ban it. And so we reached out to this author and we said, we're advocates. We're from Delaware. We want to do what you talk about in your article. We want to ban lead paint on outdoor structures. And he didn't think we could do it. He thought that it would be too hard. And he was like, okay, well, you know, you can try. And we did. And we called him from the car on the way home after the bill had, you know, passed. And he was shocked, absolutely shocked, because this is just such a, it's such a big problem that hasn't been addressed federally. And the lead paint manufacturers are still operating, and some of them have committed to, you know, like reducing the amount of lead paint. But, you know, lead is a global problem, and we have different things to reduce lead exposure in the United States. And then we have big gaps in things that we're not doing. One of the huge gaps, one of the places where other states have gone way beyond us, is in rental housing. And that's something we're working on right now. Maryland, New Jersey, Philadelphia, a lot of other states and localities have required rental housing to be made lead safe before a tenant can occupy it. And we don't have any protections for lead in rental housing, and it is a principal driver of childhood lead poisoning in this state.
Yeah, one thing I think, one of the only things I know about it is the nasty consequences of childhood sort of exposure to lead. I mean, it's absolutely poisonous, and I'm always struck by any kind of argument that would be like, no, we're going to reduce the amount of poison, and potentially, it's I'm always interested in the pushback, and of course the first thing you said was the interests that make lead paint. Well, obviously they think it's fine. Yeah, so that's not too shocking. Where are you on the idea that any rental needs to be lead free before other tenants get into it? I mean, is there a movement? Is there a bill? Are there legislators you're talking to? And if so, what is the pushback that you're getting?
There is a bill. It is HB 70. It was filed in early March. It hasn't had a hearing in the House yet. And it would require rental properties to be inspected for lead that were built before the federal ban on the sale of lead paint for residential use. So that's like the magic date is 1978. So anything built prior to that has a greater chance of having lead paint in the unit. So that piece of legislation has a lot of problems with it. It I think would need to be amended dramatically in order to get the bill in a place where it could actually have an impact on childhood lead poisoning. But the concept is that you inspect rental housing. If there are lead hazards, you have to fix them. And if there's still lead left in the unit with the hazards fixed, you have to then reinspect so that, because lead can come back up to the surface. It's the kind of thing that can emerge over time, natural wear and tear of lead painted surfaces and things like that, and then it can become a problem. So you can paint your windowsills now and cover the lead, and then in a couple of years you've got a lead hazard again. So, but that legislation was introduced by Representative Harris, we're hoping that it can be amended so that some of the problems with the bill can be fixed.
I would like to ask, and I'll be very upfront. My assumption is that the folks who are landlords and rentiers and get rental income are probably not for this. Is that the only sort of sticking point? Because you would think, I guess there's a cost sort of involved in it. So that's really the only thing I can think of that would stop us from making sure that people don't get poisoned. I don't know if you want to kind of talk to that. I mean, I assume so. I don't know what sort of opposition you're facing and what sort of opposition you're needing to overcome to move this forward.
I've had two experiences with the landlords that I can talk about. One is that I was involved in the process of the before this bill, there was a plan developed by the Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Advisory Committee. I was involved in that process of drafting that and submitting it to the General Assembly, and the landlords were involved in that and were hostile. There were a number of arguments made at the meetings. They were all public meetings, so everything that was said was on the record. Some of the arguments made were, why should we care about children and lead poisoning? Like a complete lack of empathy or respect for children who are poisoned in their homes that they're renting from you. So that was shocking to me. Absolutely shocking. I also attended a meeting over the, I think it was in December, by a landlord organization in Wilmington. They invited me to talk about the plan. And I went and explained to them what the plan involves. And they were outraged. They were outraged that anyone would have the audacity to interfere with their business model. So the cost was a primary complaint. But also in Delaware, we don't have any way of counting or tracking any rental properties. The city of Wilmington has a rental housing registry. City of Newark has a rental housing registry. Most municipalities do not have any way of tracking rental properties. Newcastle County has a apparently optional registry. Kent and Sussex County have nothing. So in order to make sure that housing is safe for lead, you have to know what housing is rental. And that, I think, is opening a door that sort of shine some light on the black box of the rental market in this state. And I think there's hostility against that as a concept.
I'll just add on to that. I think if you look at what's happened in other states, if you look at like Maryland, which has really been doing amazing things around, trying to create a model for lead safe housing. There's a difference too. You mentioned lead free. Lead safe housing is really something that is kind of probably more attainable, creating a way for inspections to happen, to get something lead free is probably going to be more difficult, but lead safe, where there's no open hazards. Where I was going with what I was saying is, so having done advocacy in other areas, if you think about something like Denrac or the refinery, people will do something if it's allowed. This idea that, people are going to police themselves and do, things for the right reason. I love that. But that's not what happens. And I think that's where the role of our state government is so critical. So yes, we're getting pushback from landlords, which is to be expected. And I think this is where the role of, you know, the, state government, you know, the governor's office, the Department of Public Health, all of these groups really need to push. They're all, people are constantly looking to them for guidance. And I think that's where there's a gap in Delaware. In other states, I don't notice that. When we speak with people in Maryland, they have a very strong, you know, state government. And I feel it's a similar when we've spoken to people from Philadelphia, you know, and I think there's just something missing. You know, it's almost like the anticipation of the pushback is enough in Delaware to create this thing. Well, we can't do it. And it's like, well, you talk about cost. I have been involved in a lot of things over the years, and we're very concerned about, you know, children's scores in school. Well, this is directly linked to it. So the costs of lead exposure are being passed along to our educational system. They're being passed along to extra need for, you know, special services for children. You know, it's the costs are going to our prisons. I mean, there are literally so many, lead goes into so many areas that it is costing. And there are reliable analysis showing how much money it costs to remediate and how much you get return on investment. And so I think that reluctance to like kind of just take it on head on and say like, look, this is a problem. All these other states are fixing it. Like they're at least working on it. We should work on it too. It shouldn't be people out here like Amy and I trying to like pull together, you know, and convince landlords. This is where we provide the information and the state's like, yeah, this is a good idea. We should do this. So I think that's an additional level of pushback that I'm not sure that the state has the ability to do what is required.
That is such an interesting concept. And I want to show you guys something. Unfortunately, you weren't able to come into the studio. That's fine. Anybody who's ever been interviewed or been part of the show virtually always has an open invitation to come back. But I want to show you what you're missing, because you said something that was very important, and I want to underscore it. So hold on one moment. This bell, this turtle bell, this turtle is named Pierre Dupont, and we have this turtle in the studio so that when somebody says something that is clearly like something we accept in Delaware as the way it works, but is ludicrous on its face. And Sarah, you just said, and I don't remember the exact words, but I was trying to quickly write it down, but you were the response to the fear of perceived pushback. So we're ringing the bell. That's classic Delaware way. We don't know if the Chamber of Commerce or landlords will like it or not, but if we think they won't like it, we're already afraid. We already are having trouble sleeping if we even know that. So I'm not surprised to hear you say that. And I just wanted to introduce you to Pierre, the Delaware Way turtle bell.
That's amazing. I love that. I love that. Well, as I mentioned earlier, Sarah and I are really into the nerd side of advocacy. And so we haven't hit the books. And there is a long, elaborate history of lead and paint and landlord pushback and everything that is happening now in Delaware and the things I experienced in my two primary interactions with the landlords is straight out of what the arguments were of the Lead Industries Association in the 1930s, the 1920s, the 1940s, when people first started talking about this and saying, hey, we need to do something with the lead in these urban rental houses. So it's not new at all. And yet, despite all of those arguments, states like Maryland and Baltimore was first took action and have dramatically reduced their childhood lead poisoning rates. So
I think this is a good time to sort of segue a little bit into the other thing I wanted to talk about, because Amy, what you just said is extremely relevant. All of these arguments go back to the beginning of the century, to the Gilded Age, which some say we may be experiencing a new one of. This idea that, and I don't remember which of you mentioned it, but the idea that you're interfering, oh, it was Amy when you spoke in Wilmington to the landlords, you're interfering with our process. See, our process is to make passive income off of these homes, and if they're poisoned or not, it's really none of my business. And this is something that's rearing its head again. And I've been told, I have to be very honest, I've been told that both of you are sort of outspoken about this dynamic just in general, with our legislature even. And I'm so happy to hear that when I was thinking about who I was going to speak to and sort of what they're kind of getting into. I really appreciate that. Because it's as important as it's ever been to sort of point that out.
Thank you for that. I think Sarah and I have always been very much a truth to power kind of thing. I think that that's a principle in environmental justice, and we are very deeply embedded in that ideal to accomplish environmental justice and the hypocrisy that happens everywhere, including local governments or the General Assembly. You know, someone needs to stand up and say something truthful, and we're not going to miss an opportunity to do that.
Yeah, you sort of mentioned it, sort of talking about other places. Like, I think people have this idea that DENREC, the natural resources and the state and, you know, inspections and licensing, that they have, you know, sort of your best interest in mind, or the best interest of the regular person, or the renter or the leasee or the child or whatever it is. And you think, well, they're going to at least at that level sort of be sort of a safeguard. But that is not true. And so, you know, we get into a situation where even implementation or accepting that something is a problem sort of doesn't happen at all. I'm interested in, and maybe this will shed some light on it as far as I'm concerned, because I do sort of advocacy and activism too around other sort of legislative issues, police reform being like the biggest one. And I'm extremely interested in how people who have strong, not only strong ideas, but just basic science, basic facts to try to balance things out or protect, you know, people who can't be protected, have to run up against this idea that that has to be weighed against somebody's ability to make a dollar. And yeah, I just wonder what kind of experience you've had specifically with that kind of stuff. Because I'm running into it just like everyone else, I guess.
It's a constant. And I think it's an underlying pillar of the Delaware way, is this prioritization of the profit motive and the structure of government, the structure of social interaction that influences policy wraps around all of that. And I think that is truly unfortunate. It is truly unfortunate because it makes it so much harder to make a crack in the foundation. One of the problems with advocacy, and Sarah and I started this lead poisoning problem, we started in 2016. So we are now almost a decade into this. And I think about what we've accomplished, and we've accomplished a lot, but we haven't accomplished a lot. And so one of the problems is you've got to have stamina, right? You can't just fix things quickly. Like, things might seem obvious to you. Oh my gosh, this is a terrible injustice. It is not fair. there are real victims here. But it takes forever, it feels, to get certain things resolved. It's unbelievable. I mean, the fact that we are dealing with things like in Delaware in 2025 that other states dealt with decades ago kind of is astonishing.
And I think it's that continuous need to be on top of everything and to be present and to be in rooms where things are being discussed. It's like, Amy, I think it's funny because I think when I first start on something, I feel very loud, but I feel like anymore, it's not just speaking up, it's being there and just continuously letting people know that you're watching them. You're watching them and you're going to continue watching them. And it's, you're not going away, because that's ultimately, I think, the goal of a lot of, you know, pushback, because they're like, ah, oh, these people just, can they go away? Can they just like stop making noise? And that's, I think, just continuously being, you know, following all these things. I mean, nothing we've worked on has been that fast. It's
case in point. Let's do a case in point. We wanted to, so Delaware requires all children to be tested for lead when they're 1 year old. It's been in place since the Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Act was signed into law in 1994. And we wanted to add 2 years old to the thing, because 2 years old is considered a best practice. 2 years old is part of the this chart that the physicians use called the Bright Futures Schedule of Periodicity. 2 years old is part of what the children who get Medicaid benefits receive. 2 years old is a best practice in other states, and we wanted 2 years old. And it took three rounds in the General Assembly to get two-year testing for lead poisoning as a, you know, universal mandate. And that was signed into law in 2021. It took three tries. The first try, it was killed by the Medical Society of Delaware. Second try, it was killed by a more coordinated effort that included the Medical Society of Delaware, AI DuPont-Nemours pediatricians, and at the time, the director of public health at the state, who was also a pediatrician, Dr. Carol Rattay. They had a coordinated effort to kill it at that time, and it died in committee.
Now, is this was the pushback from the Health and Human Services and the doctors cost based, or are they just saying, well, it has to be cost-based, because otherwise maybe they would say it's not necessary at this time. But if that's the standard in all of these other places, it's a very difficult argument to make. So was it once again just you're imposing a test that's going to cost money? Is that it?
There were a couple of complaints. One of the complaints was that doctors, screening for lead is like a finger stick that goes into a machine. They call it point of care in a doctor's office, or you could get a venous draw, which is like where you go to a lab and they put the little thing around your arm and they pump it up and then they stick a needle right in the inside of your elbow. So those are the two kinds of lead tests. And so doctors were saying that to have the point of care equipment in the office is expensive. They were saying that it takes time, valuable time, away from what they are doing with their patient. The director of public health, Dr. Carol Rattay, said lead screening, the finger stick, harms children. Harms children. She said that on the record. So there were a lot of, the arguments kept getting more extreme and more absurd. And ultimately, I think that we prevailed in two-year testing because we kept coming back. We kept coming back, and it became obvious that this was never going to end. We latched on, and we were not going to give up, and we were going to keep bringing legislation forward. We were going to keep working with allies. We were going to keep coordinating until we got all kids tested when they turned two. So on the third round, we won. Two-year testing is now law in Delaware. We've caught up with a lot of other places, and we have it. But it's been a terrible struggle. And then in some cases, things have gone backwards. For example, school nurses. Things went really sideways and backwards with school nurses. So, who checks to make sure a kid has their lead tests? Well, school nurses do that when kids enroll in kindergarten. They've been doing that work for decades. That was part of the original Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Act, and we love our school nurses. School nurses have a hard time fulfilling that requirement because they didn't have access to the database that the state has where they keep track of every kid and their lead test. So for years, they would get on the phone. They would call the Division of Public Health and they would say, Johnny and Sally, they don't have a lead test in their records. Do you have a lead test for them? And then if they had a lead test, they'd check it off. But if they didn't have a lead test, they'd send them back to the doctor. Well, school nurses were like, okay, we want more. We want to know which kids are lead poisoned. That initiated a very strange series of events where the state decided they were going to cut off all access to everything to school nurses. School nurses no longer had the ability to pick up the phone and call the Division of Public Health. They had nothing. So we had to do legislation to restore something that had always been a practice. And we did that. And it was just like, okay, like our capacity is not infinite. But this is what we're doing, right? We're putting things back into place that someone, for some reason, without notif like the school nurses were not notified. The public was, there was no press release. There was no letter that went out. It just got shut off. It's like somebody went to the tap and said, no more data for you. So we had to have that restored. And then we wanted to add results on. So that school nurses could know which kids had lead poisoning and which don't. And that really matters in a school setting because lead poisoning can impact all kinds of special needs. For example, nutritional supports or special education services. So school nurses can make that referral if they know which kids were exposed. And the state slapped the largest fiscal note on that you ever saw.
Ah, the fiscal note. I should grab the bell again.
Yeah,
I
the
didn't hit the
largest
bell
fiscal
again.
note you ever saw. So that part got dropped out, but then we regrouped, and we brought it back. And now, technically, school nurses have access to results, although the system is not yet in place where they can just like log in and see.
And they can do
So
that for other things. They can do that for the vaccine, the
vaccines.
Delvax, because they're registered nurses. And at the time they turned off the access for school nurses, we heard something about, it's a HIPAA concern. And oh my gosh, school nurses have access to those things. They're registered nurses. Like this is already happening for other issues. We have School nurses have the ability to see if the state has a record of things. But for this particular thing, lead poisoning is always treated differently. It's always this like thing that's like, well, we've never done this before. And it's like, we do it for so many other things, but lead is always like, well, this is so different. And it's like, it's really not that different. It should be routine, but it's not ever routine.
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to say, we're a big nurse. We love nurses here. Very famously, my missus, Nurse Susan, is a nurse. That's why we call her Nurse Susan. And I do have to say, it's always funny when people bring up HIPAA because they'll say something about HIPAA, this, or whatever it is, and then they'll walk away, and Nurse Susan will be like, "Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. That has nothing to do with anything." It's like people know a thing to say, and that's what they're going to go with. So. That I understand. I'm interested, and this is like this is the fun portion of the conversation. We'll see where it goes. See if you're interested, because I kind of want to broaden this out a little bit because all of this sort of points to a frustration that I've had for a very long time. It's starting to bubble to the surface. And my frustration is that when we have to do these things in a political environment here in Delaware, we're generally dealing with Democrats. And we, to some extent or another, all think of ourselves as liberal. Like, I don't think of myself as liberal because I'm a dirty communist. But the fact of the matter is, because I live in the United States, I'm basically liberal. There's no other choice in the matter. So we're running up against people who, from an electoral sort of political standpoint, really should be our allies in the dynamic that Amy was describing earlier about government looking out for people, looking out for kids, making sure that people just don't run roughshod over everything and poison us whenever they can because they can, like it's 1880 again. Some of them actually, not only would we assume would be our natural allies, some of them used to be our allies. And now we see that they have sort of other interests that are pulling against them, and it's extremely frustrating. And I also think that this dynamic is creating a problem because the only people in the political realm that can protect us from literally the worst of the worst are Democrats, and they have shown really no appetite to do it. And I know that Amy, especially, I'm not on Facebook. I thank goodness I never went down that road. But I do see a Facebook post from time to time that people think that I would think is funny. And I have seen, Amy, some of your posts, and I do appreciate some of your posts along these lines. I just have to say that. And then I'll allow you guys to sort of elaborate on this point, but I wanted to mention that.
Well, you have a little bit of a sense of my sick sense of humor, which is all a trauma response. So I guess you do know me. This is a terrible problem. You put a very fine point on it, which is that we have a lot of these Democrats in name only, the dinos, and these principles of circling the wagon and protecting the political machine instead of, you know, representing your district is extremely problematic. And there have been legislators that have been champions to the very last day of their term in office, like Representative Kowalko. And you may disagree with him on policy.
We never disagree with Kowalko.
Never disagreed on policy. He was my representative. I worked with him very, very closely. And also back in 2013 and 2014, I was very involved in the effort in Newark to stop the power plant that was planned for the University of Delaware. And Representative Kowalko was very with us. He was with us. It became a brawl in this town.
We call John our representative emeritus. He's been in this studio several times. I'm very happy to call him a friend of mine. And although you know sometimes he goes off half cocked, sometimes I do as well, and that's all in the game. You'll never hear me in public badmouth John Kowalko at all. Love the guy. Beautiful.
He's a lion. He's a lion, but he's rare. And a lot of people are, I think, they have very good intentions before they get into office. And there's this concept that I fall back to all the time, which is you have objectivity or you have solidarity. And Objectivity is a fallacy. It's like you have solidarity with something, and the people who run for office have solidarity with the people. They have ideals, whatever, and then at some point they start to have solidarity with their party. They start to have solidarity with government. They start to have solidarity with the administration, and they start to have solidarity with staff. And when that happens, they're just gone, right? When you start to put the structure of government ahead of the people, you are so content. Like, what are you even doing there? And unfortunately, that is happening at a more rapid pace, I think, than ever. And it may be just, the times, like everything is accelerated. I don't know the driver, but I see it happen with so many. It's like all of a sudden, okay, you've been contaminated by the process or the building or whatever it is down there that does that in Dover, and now you're no longer for us. So that's so disappointing. That never happened to John Kowalko. That never happened to him.
And I will also add,
Correct.
Representative Lambert is excellent.
Oh, yes.
He's another person who is in office that really continues to listen to people and their concerns, and he's a real champion as well.
He's a champion for lead. He is a real fighter for children, and lead poisoning is an issue, and we truly love him. But it's just there's a sort of like a sorority type feel to it, which I think is just seems to be getting worse. And
Yeah, I think that's the frustration is that as much work as is done, and much work has been done. I'm not going to ask Carl to come off of come into the Zoom, but as much work as has been done, and great work has been done. Larry Lambert, fantastic. Medina, fantastic. We know this. So there are people who are going to listen, but. As you said, the sorority, once you get initiated into sorority, it's very, very, it really is tantalizing. You really feel like you have to do this. And it's actually not good for anybody. And it's real disappointing. The other thing I find, and maybe you're running into this too, is that when you look at people who say they love democracy, the last thing they want to hear from you is that you might vote for someone else, or you might support someone else, or you might find someone who's going to primary them if they don't come off of what they're standing on. And that is like the most offensive thing you can say in Delaware. It makes people so upset. But I was. My assumption was that like democracy was like a thing that we were all we didn't want to lose it and it was under threat and we know we really love it. But if you talk about using it in the way that it's commonly understood, it's a huge insult to people. And so, we find ourselves in a very, 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 very strange situation, I feel.
I mean, there's this. I have watched this over the years, and I think the whole federal thing that's happening right now is like facilitating this even more, where, we don't have really all. First of all, in Delaware, we all know that our primaries are where the election happens. By the time, if your district is a certain way, it's, certain party's never going to win. So it's like it all happens in the primaries. And yeah, there's so much pressure to just, go with the party, go with the party. And I mean, if you are not a Democrat, you will not vote in Delaware. So, I mean, you won't really have many primaries. I mean, there's just it is very interesting, and it doesn't create an atmosphere of like accountability or growth at all. It just creates, like you're saying, kind of this status quo thing where it's like, well, you wouldn't vote for the person, so you have to vote for this person. And it's like, really? That's how we're doing it? We're just saying, like, I don't know. It's
In
strange.
addition to
Definitely
the
strange.
votes and the primary issue is that government continues to operate behind closed doors. They are concealing their operations. The General Assembly has exempted itself from Title 29, Chapter 100, the Freedom of Information Act, for like a lot of it. And that is so very damaging. I mean, we just had an attorney general's opinion on the Joint Legislative Oversight and Sunset Committee. They are reviewing at we had a petition hundreds of people signed to have the Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program reviewed by the Sunset Committee. That was a couple of years ago, so it's up for review now. And they expanded their review to include all kinds of other entities and didn't put them on their agenda. They didn't put the Department of Education on the agenda. They didn't put these other the these other they only put the Childhood Lead Poisoning Prevention Program, but they use that as a they can talk about anything with lead. And I'm thinking, okay, that doesn't sound right. The Attorney General's opinion is they're exempt. They don't have to abide by transparency measures for agendas in this. If we don't have a transparent agendas that list the topics we're going to discuss, you can't trust anything that happens in the building. Like I said earlier, if it keeps going to the point it becomes absurd, it is absurd. Why have agendas at all?
Yeah, I think I'll close on this, and then you guys can add whatever you like. I know that there is a fear in some circles, an existential fear of options, of the Larry Lamberts and the John Kowalkos of the world and the Medinas of the world, Sophie Phillips, Ray Moore. There's a fear of that. Because people are looking for real options that are going to represent their interests, that are going to protect kids, working families, small W, small F. And so that's going to just continue. I think when you talk to sort of lifetime advocates and people who are neck deep in their issue, working this kind of stuff every day and trying to get just basic reforms done, you can hear the frustration. And there's help coming. It's going to be pretty clear where that help is coming from an electoral standpoint. I'm not going to say it because I say it all the time. I'm not going to burden you guys with me saying it. But everybody knows what it is. So when those alternatives come and you know you have to step up, you got to step up and support these alternatives. Because that's the only way we're going to make any headway with kids being poisoned, with money going out the door to every private interest you can think of, to the state government trying to privatize your parents' health care, to giving it away to the biggest oligarchs in the country on a corporate bill, all of it. So, that's the lesson I take from conversations like this with local activists and advocates, and I hope that starts to resonate with people because I think it's super important, especially now because things are getting a little bit dicey. We'll just put it that way.
Yeah, it's a very tough time to be an advocate, but it has always been a tough time to be an advocate. And I think about that, and like, if you want to do the work, right? If you want to make the change, if you want to be part of the thing and actually do advocacy and not just be an activist, right? Not just be in the street, but like work on policy, then you have to do your homework. You have to be prepared to be disliked a lot. You have to be prepared to fail over and over again until you succeed. You have to, and Sarah and I talk to students, and this is one of the things we tell students when we talk to them, is you have to work with people you trust. So, we're very lucky because we're a good group here. But it's just a tough t it's always a tough time to be an advocate. We stand on the shoulders of a lot of folks, for a lot of years, and I it's just it's never easy, but it's going to get harder.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, there's a very well-known quote from FDR, who said, you know, all of these interests, economic royalists and capital interests, are unanimous in their hatred for him, and he welcomed their hatred. The fact of the matter is that it's not always comfortable when people are mad at you or shit talk you behind your back or, you know, think you're not part of the, you know, you're not part of the clique. I don't want to be part of the clique. I'm not fucking interested in it. I'm interested in kids not getting poisoned and cops stopping to beat people. That's pretty much it. Like, I don't care if I'm in any club.
Well, you know, this is one of the things about doing advocacy in your own community,
yeah.
Right? Is because people know where you live.
Right.
People know where you live. When we were fighting the power plant, I had people waiting for me outside my front door.
That's right.
To give me shit. When we were working on the refinery and the air monitoring, mm-hmm. the refinery called the police on us. Mm-hmm. We had to deal with cops and a bucket air monitor, like on the side of the road kind of thing. It's just like, you know, like the level. Well, oh my goodness. Do you remember the time we were chased by the guy with the wrench? We were chased by a guy with like one of those giant pipe wrenches.
We're taking photographs.
We were taking pictures
from the road, like a Google map would. It was nothing like we weren't on.
We were taking pictures of like some barrels on the side of the road.
from the road.
And yeah, chased by a guy with a giant pipe wrench. Like the stuff gets real, you know. There have been times where I have felt like the work that we do is dangerous.
Yeah, and it's always been like that. And I think that's the part that no matter who's in power, no matter, you know, a lot of people I've been talking to recently, like, well, what are you going to do now? And I'm like, the thing is, it looks different. I mean, yeah, it's going to get way worse, but it's always been really hard because even when you have those people in government or agencies that are allies, there's still this other stuff going on, like Amy said. I mean, it's...
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I try to do, anybody who's in a position to do it, and you two are incredible spokespeople for it, is you can't be afraid. You know, you take a stand for solidarity. You're not looking to equivocate or be objectivist. You know, you take a stand for it and you do it. And if we do it together, they can't get us all. And, you know, and it actually makes you feel good when, because I can tell talking to you too, when I talk to people who have accomplished like real legislation, real things, where you're like, these children are being tested and things are being, you know, done where we're not putting so much poison in the water and the air. It feels good. You feel like you've really accomplished something. And, you know, that's what I'm going for. And I love to hear it. I love to hear it.
The win is amazing. The win makes it.
Because there's a lot of time in between.
Yeah.
Savor the W's because I don't know if you've noticed, our side, we take a lot of L's.
We do. It takes a lot of times coming back. There's a quote I really love by an author. Her name is Elizabeth Elliot. And I think that this really kind of sums it up, which is sometimes fear does not subside and you must choose to do it afraid. And I feel as though, you know, I am a tender heart. You know, I feel it really deep and hard, but I don't give a fuck. Like, I will sacrifice my own comfort. I don't care if I'm liked or disliked. You know, I'll do my homework. Look at this. I have this hat I put on. I did my homework. And I'll sit here smug. Like, you know, you're not going to win this on facts because we're going to circle you. Right. We're going to outcircle you on the nerd part. And we're going to drain it. This is how every campaign is this way. But, you know, hopefully it won't take three tries on rental housing. Hopefully it'll just take the two because this is the second year that this has come up.
Well, I want to thank you guys so much. I know we've been trying to put this together for seems like a couple months. I don't know why.
Yeah,
I don't
thank know you for did. Being flexible on our schedule. That's very, very nice.
That's perfectly fine. I know how difficult it is, especially getting like more than one person. So I very much appreciate it. Amy and Sarah, thank you so much. There's going to be links in the show notes to some of this information, the work that you're doing, the legislation that's on the docket, all of that stuff, so people can get more information. And again, thanks so much.
Thank you so much. Have a great evening.
You too. And guys, remember, don't, oh my God, I almost forgot to mention, left is best. Thanks.